In our continuing series highlighting the great investors of our era, I have asked Charles Dreyfus, portfolio manager of Royce Specialty Equity Fund and the Royce Special Equity Multicap Fund, two mutual funds that combine classic value analysis, which we're going to get into a little bit, finding out what that is, with the identification of good businesses. And also, what I think is particularly interesting about Mr. Dreyfus is that he has a healthy amount of skepticism and cynicism when it comes to the way companies do their accounting. Charlie Dreyfus, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's my pleasure.
So I know that you specialize in the small cap universe. The universe of investing is quite large. Why did you choose small caps?
Well, small cap still today, but particularly when I started my career 49 years ago, was inefficient, meaning that people really didn't know that these companies even existed. So there was a discovery factor. And obviously, as we progressed in an internet age, there's less discovery, but if it exists at all, it would be in the small cap space.
Because you don't have a lot of the big investment companies and hedge funds looking at these very small companies. Why? Because it's hard to put a lot of investors' money into them. They're not that liquid.
Yes. In the parlance of Wall Street, it's not scalable, meaning you can't put a lot of money into it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you cannot build a big business. Therefore, you cannot necessarily make a lot of money for yourself. So people are less prone to investing in that. They'd rather take as much assets as they can. And if you are diligent and if you're professional and ethical, you realize that there's a capacity constraint in the small cap space. And in fact, I've closed, meaning I have not allowed new investors into my fund in a third of its 19-year history.
You have to close it in order to stop the cash flow coming in because you can't really effectively buy companies the way you want to that are so small.
That's correct. Okay. I mean, people do it, and there's an incentive for the manager in terms of assets under management, but it's an adverse outcome for the shareholder, the client.
You know, this year, growth stocks are in favor. We've seen, you know, the famous large caps, the FANG stocks, the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles of the world doing quite well. Last year, not so well, but this year, very, very well. And so the idea of buying growth stocks like those versus value stocks, which are a little bit different animal, go in and out of fashion. But when you look at small caps today, why do you choose value? And if you could take a second to explain what it means to buy a value stock, explain why value over growth.
Great question. I mean, value tends to be companies that have a cyclical element to them. They are not companies that compound at a specific growth rate, or at least a band of a growth rate over time. They have products which may not be as stable in their demand as growth stocks. They historically have actually outperformed growth stocks, but you have to be aware of, you know, when to be more aggressive in buying them and when perhaps not so. Obviously, right now, what you explained, Steve, is a recalibration. Actually, small cap stocks and small cap value stocks did very well immediately post-election because everyone was very hopeful that we would get a lot of government fiscal policies into place that would stimulate the U.S. economy. Small cap companies are U.S. centric, so they would be most impacted by positive government intervention in the economy. As it appeared post-inauguration, the likelihood of that started diminishing. And obviously, as we got further into May, it diminished even more. So there's been a recalibration away from the outperformance last year in 2016 of small cap value into large cap growth. And what people are doing, they're trying to find, in a very uncertain world, companies who will exhibit strong either revenue or earnings growth and willing to pay prices that, frankly, give me nosebleeds.
Right. Well, you know, getting back to that, so if small cap value is now out of favor to some degree, are you starting to find companies at compelling prices to buy in the area that you invest, or are things at relatively too high levels for you now?
They still remain at too high levels. I need a real market correction. By that I mean...
Don't say that.
Well, I actually am one of these eccentric people that actually welcomes that. I welcome it for two reasons. I try to build portfolios that are very defensive. They act very well during troubling markets, flat or down markets. So I outperform many times actually advancing during a declining market. Mm-hmm. But more important today is repopulating my portfolio because of the continued march post March of 2009 higher in terms of prices. It's become much more difficult to construct a portfolio which, in my case, in the small cap fund, typically has around 60 names and today has around 40 names. And that's a function of having to, I have a strong discipline both in buying and selling. And when a stock reaches what I believe the full valuation, meaning that there's no advantage to continue to own it, I will sell it. And if I can't find anything new, the residual goes to cash and cash will build.
So you have an excess amount of cash right now. If you have sold 20 out of your 60 stocks and you haven't reinvested them, that money is sitting in cash.
Correct.
Yeah.
But it's it's roughly in the 12% area. It's not something astronomical.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. You have 12% cash in your portfolios. You know, at what point in time, you know, when you make the decision, what rate of return, I guess, is your minimum requirement in order for you to decide, I like this company, but now I like this price?
Well, it's a good question. We have a formulaic approach, which, without causing your listeners to go back to business school, basically, the simple concept is we have to earn, if we bought the whole company, we would have to earn a substantial amount over the cost we would incur in borrowing the monies to buy the business. So it has to have that differential. And so we always know it generally is something of going in of a 50%. I often say what we're trying to do is buy $100 bills at $60. And so, you know, 50% above 60 would be 90. And, you know, there's a little transaction cost and noise in the system. But, you know, again, it's a moving target because earnings are changing, balance sheets are changing, prices, of course, are changing. Cost of capital, the borrowing costs that we would incur in borrowing to buy this business,
changing.
So everything is changing. So it's interestingly enough, on average, I tend to hold a stock for 4 or 5 years. I have very low turnover compared to the industry because if I truly am finding inefficiencies, by definition, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to be discovered the next day.
Well, if you're buying companies as they're declining in price, there's really a good probability that even after you buy them, they're going to continue to decline. Just because Charlie Dreyfus decides to buy doesn't mean a bell rings somewhere and you know,
yeah,
price
that's
of
a
stock.
Shame.
I know we all want that. But, you know, I wanted to ask you about the reverse. So you have this discipline when you sell a stock because you say it's fairly priced, but how many of those companies' prices continue up and up and up, and you sit there and you go, oh, you know, if I had just waited 2 weeks, if I had just waited 6 weeks, I could have gotten another 20% on this.
It happens all the time. I learned early on in my career that you cannot do could have, would have, should have, because you'll drive yourself crazy.
Right.
And what you do is you have a discipline, hopefully based in some economic, accounting, capitalistic notions that, you know, works over time. And that doesn't mean that the market can't escape from times of reality. We've seen that, you know, in the past. We may be seeing that currently. You know, the market has a way at times of neglecting reality. But it comes, you know, think of the tech bubble, and, you know, I go far enough back to the Nifty 50 of 1972, 1974.
Which were 50 of the most popular stocks, Xerox, Polaroid.
Correct.
Avon was in there years ago.
Avon, yeah. Sears, Roebuck, yeah. A lot of companies that have stumbled over the years.
Right.
It was a broader version of FANG. And so these episodes happen from time to time, and people lose their bearings as to how they should price businesses in the marketplace, and then they return to reality, often with a sharp, damaging effect on them.
One of the problems that managers have is that clients are looking at them to perform. If the market's going up, clients want their portfolios to be rising. They don't want a situation, even though, you know, the piper will or may be paid in the future, they don't want you to basically say, hey, well, we're out of the market because we think that prices are too high. And then the market continues up, you know, say the Dow another 1,000 or 2,000 points. There's a lot of pressure on managers to stay in the game. I don't think you're under that pressure.
Well, I'm sure I have some clients who have that notion, but I have always, throughout my career, tried to set expectations. The worst thing for a manager in the long run is to get a client whose objectives are different than that which are the manager's objectives.
Right.
So what I have tried to frame in terms of expectations is, I will underperform on the upside. I will not own that item that is most in fashion, as you suggested, Steve. I will own stuff that is unfashionable, that's been rejected by others, somewhat contrarian, but with a discipline.
Right.
And therefore, I have a long history of underperforming the upside. But the simple math is, if you outperform the downside, the technical phrase here is upside downside capture ratios. And if you have a history of doing so much better during adverse times, you keep the corpus, the money, intact so that you can participate during the up times. It's the mathematical truism. If you decline 50%, you have to be up 100% just to be even. You don't want to be in that position.
You don't want to dig a hole so deep. So you may see the S&P, you know, was up 40-50%, but then the year before it was down 40%. It doesn't mean that you've broken even. As a matter of fact, it's
correct.
Far from it. You need 100%. We don't have much time left. I really, one of the parts of your talk when I heard you out in Omaha a few weeks ago was you were talking about a mentor of yours, Abe Briloff, who was really a maverick in the accounting industry, which, you know, I think is kind of an oxymoron. But tell me a little bit about Abe Briloff. Bring us in, because he's kind of a hero, and yet I don't think many people have heard of him.
Yes, Abe Briloff, B-R-I-L-O-F-F, and I would encourage your listeners to Google him. He was the leading forensic accountant in the United States. He passed away a couple of years back at age 96 and a half. For much of his career, the last 25 years, he was legally blind, but yet was very prolific. His advocacy was that it's the company and accountants' responsibilities to portray financial information as it best resembles the economic reality. And shame on companies that portrayed it, obviously, in most instances, in a more favorable light than it's deserved.
Mm-hmm.
But even greater shame and scathing articles attacking the auditing profession for allowing it. His belief was, and I concurred, obviously, that the auditors are the ombudsman. They should be the protectors for the consumers of the financial statements such that we get economic reality. So Abe's addition to the notion of accountancy was not the, so much the construction of it. I was an accounting major undergrad. I did extremely well, but I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only in a graduate program where I had Abe as a professor,
mm-hmm.
and Abe taught us the deconstruction
mm-hmm.
of financial statements.
Yeah.
And frankly, without Abe Briloff, there would be no Charlie Dreyfus. My entire career, I owe to him.
I want to end with a quote that I heard you say at the conference, and that is, Abe said, "We don't need more accounting principles. We need more accountants with principle." And on that note, I'd like to
amen.
Thank. Yeah, amen. I'd like to thank Charlie Dreyfus, portfolio manager of the Roy Special Equity Fund and Roy Special Equity Multicap Fund, for joining me today. Charlie, it was a great interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
To find out more about Charlie and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com.